Welcome to Put Simply, the podcast that puts what's happening in the world simply without compromising on the details. Erdem Koch is my name, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Ozan Ibrahim and Rodney McCune. Gents, wonderful to see you again.
Good to be with you.
Good to see you both.
Well, we started last week's podcast with the trade war that Donald Trump effectively begun imposing tariffs on multiple countries. More announcements have been made on that, but there's another war that Trump himself has effectively started this week, him and those close to him, and that is the one on the judiciary. Some interesting developments in the United States. We did say that we don't want to just exclusively cover Trump and the presidency on this podcast, but boy, oh boy, there is so much happening and there are so many implications for the rest of the world. Rodney, take us through what is happening from this point of view that the judiciary is intervening in multiple executive orders signed by Trump and, well, comments by his vice president that, well, they may not listen to some of them.
Yeah, there's obviously a whole raft of executive orders. There's DOGE charging around into every department that gets the keys to access information, try and lay off members of federal staff and so on. And at various points, there are legal challenges being put down to their actions to say, are they ultra vires outside their power? And there's been an interim stay on one of the recent actions, and that's what's triggered both J.D. Vance and Musk in what is a coordinated effort to challenge whether the judiciary can stand in the way of executive power. It's not dissimilar to what happened during the Brexit, post-Brexit period in the UK, when there was a judicial ruling that the consent of Parliament was needed to trigger Article 50, which was the one which gave notice to the European Union that the UK was going to leave. The right-wing newspaper, the Daily Mail, the next day printed photographs of the judges, which under the heading of enemies of the people, the House of Lords judges or Supreme Court judges as it is now in the UK, who gave the ruling. And the judiciary are in a difficult position on this stuff because, you know, they are subject to a whipped up crowd of MAGA fanatics who feel that they are blocking because they're part of some great left woke conspiracy, the right actions of Trump and Vance. And if there's not some form of check in executive power, well, there's no balance of the powers in the US. The Constitution isn't going to be worthy of anything at all. And, you know, they're really testing this stuff. And it relies on the fact that both the other arms of government respect judicial rulings. And Trump has never respected the courts. He's always seen them as something that you just keep pushing at. We knew that from what happened before the election and the multitude of cases both he challenged against the previous election, but also cases that he was responding to, both criminal and civil. It's a game for people like that. It's a money exercise. It's a delaying exercise. It's about commenting outside court and saying what you want to say, despite the fact that you might be in contempt of court. And now, post-election, he's a much bigger figure and he's got more scope for doing that. And there's no one holding him back. So it's potential real difficulty for the US because, you know, if the judicial rulings that do come through, even if they're subject to appeal and so on, aren't respected, they really are moving into the autocratic space in a very significant way. So it is quite a serious point of where America is and where it might go in the coming months with the Trump administration deciding not to honor these types of rulings. And, you know, Musk has no difference in terms of his approach from that of Trump or Vance. You know, the distinction, if any, is paper thin. So quite a serious time in America, I think. Ozan, I don't know what you think about it.
No, I 100% agree. I think this is a very, very dangerous time. It's a very dangerous thing to do to to declare war on the judiciary. At the end of the day, it's you cannot be president of a country like the United States with its firm democratic principles, institutions, and pick and choose which judicial decisions that you will comply with. I mean, this is well and truly on the path to becoming, as you said, an autocratic state. Because at the end of the day, what you see and what we've seen in many other countries is you are effectively, by not complying with judicial decisions, you are also sending a very firm message to other members of the judiciary that in future they should be very careful about how they rule, and they will be effectively bullied into making rulings that are very much in favor of the administration and its actions and the executive. And this is not how a democracy should be operating. And the one country that claims to be very much far down in the whole democracy experiment, this is extremely dangerous. If you ask me, out of all of the things that we've seen, this to me is kind of the most dangerous and one of the things where you can finally say that the judiciary, I mean, sorry, the democracy that we knew the US to be is falling apart. Now, the argument from the MAGA types and others is that this judge is corrupt, and you know, if there was a judicial decision that was in favor of what they were doing or ruled in favor, etc., obviously that judge is not corrupt. So even this sort of rhetoric, even if Trump ends up complying with whatever decisions the judiciary make, this sort of rhetoric is significantly damaging the credibility of this very important institution that is there to hold checks and balances on executive power and the power of the Congress as well. And it is very, very dangerous, and I think it's something that we need to keep an eye out. This is exactly how the likes of Steve Bannon and other MAGA types, over years of persistent messaging, were able to completely devalue the mainstream media, and now they're onto the judiciary. And this is what autocratic leaders and their allies do. They start to discredit and devalue and raise suspicion about institutions so that they can weaken them. And it's a sad day, to be honest with you.
Let's take a step back and understand here the principles of the rule of law, something that the American Bar Association has come out in a very strongly worded letter saying that, you know, the administration cannot decide which laws it's going to follow and which is not. This is not just about the executive and the judiciary. It's also the legislature, those three arms of government that have to remain independent from one another to ensure that one particular arm does not have any more power than the other. And I think what is important here in the outrage is to be very clear that no one is suggesting that the judiciary should be above the executive. No one is suggesting that the legislature should be above the judiciary. You see where I'm going with this point. The idea is that there are checks and balances embedded in democratic systems to ensure that one particular arm does not have any more power than the other. However, what happens when the President of the United States and his loyalists and his followers decide that they're not going to listen to the judiciary? Because the system only works is if the three arms of government cooperate with one another. I mean, Trump. And this is where it's very fragile, right? Trump could effectively, although it's embedded in the US Constitution, Trump could effectively just simply not listen to these orders and continue his actions. The question is, what's the enforcement to ensure that the rule of law and the separation of powers is upheld? Rodney.
Contempt of court is the most obvious sanction for breach of a judicial ruling about whether something is lawful or not, in terms of the powers that they're exercising. The issue then is whether the bullying culture, which is endemic in a administration like this means that the senior people instruct the junior people to continue with the unlawful act, or whether the junior people feel empowered by the ruling to resist it. And that becomes then another point of friction, because then no doubt they become dismissed or something. And then you find yourself going round again on the same sort of rat run or whatever. But it really requires a level of respect for the rulings, and the rulings of the Supreme Court should something go that far by way of challenge. And contempt of court, yes, a judge can rule someone in contempt. They could be, as we know from Trump and his outbursts in his previous trials, they could be arrested and detained and punished for being in contempt of court. But I think they're calculating, as I'm sure we would observe, that it's highly unlikely that the US sitting president is going to be detained for contempt of court should he choose to ignore these rulings. So that's why you could be at the early stages of a constitutional crisis in America. It depends what happens in relation to these rulings over the next period of time, and how government lawyers and those who are putting in challenges respond to whatever it might be. I mean, this current example where Musk's out calling for people to be impeached, or the judge to be impeached, which isn't an often used thing anyway in America, though it is used on occasion, is because he ruled against whether non-civil servants were able to have access to the federal payment system. I mean, the type of issue that they're ignoring the courts on, or potentially going to ignore the courts on, it isn't even the biggest issue yet. And it's not one that perhaps would get the American public on the side of Musk or Vance necessarily on that. But there will be other issues, potentially in relation to deportations or other things, where it may whip up quite a storm of opinion in favour of ignoring the judicial ruling. So the checks and balances only work if each element respects the other, and America feels like it's tiptoeing into a space where they're not respecting each other, and that's why it's going to be, or could become, dangerous.
As the only person without a law degree in this group, I'm going to leave the legal elements to you two, but I think politically Trump would be very well served if he started ignoring the judgments of a federal court judge who was effectively appointed by Barack Obama. You know, where the legal side is, I'm not sure. I think it's been very rare that a president, I think, in fact, if I understand it correctly, the last time that a court ruling was ignored by a sitting president was during the Civil War, when President Abraham Lincoln defied Supreme Court justice and a Supreme Court ruling. I believe Richard Nixon contemplated defying a court order, but ultimately he didn't. So we would be in uncharted territory. However, with effectively Trump and his allies controlling the airwaves, controlling the kind of propaganda machine, etc. I think Trump, you would probably see an increase in Trump's numbers, because unfortunately, Elon, through his platform, Elon Musk, has effectively set the ground for convincing people that this federal court judge, who is hostile to the movement and to the cause, is corrupt and he needs to be removed. So I see very little resistance to it politically. I think, as Rodney said, I think the American public are sleepwalking into a constitutional crisis, and this would bolster the kind of tough man image that Trump has been portraying, and very much boost his political kind of numbers and his political stance. But most importantly, what it would do is it would continue to send a message that if you're in my way, I'm going to bulldoze through you. And I respect no norms. I respect no institutions. I don't respect the Constitution as it's as it comes about, or as it is supposed to be respected. As Rodney said, this is a very dangerous time. And I think, you know, I can't see anything stopping him if he decides to go against this this court order.
Do you know, I don't know whether he was still president or afterwards, but Clinton was held in contempt of court in relation to Monica Lewinsky, but it was a very different situation. It was to do with what evidence he gave, rather than some executive power that he was failing to allow to be checked by the court. So I maybe need to tidy up slightly, saying it hasn't happened before that a president has been in contempt, or a sitting president, because it may have been just at the end of his term. But irrespective of that, it wasn't to do with his exercise of power, where the courts were saying it was unlawful, use of presidential executive order or whatever it happens to be. So we're still in new territory with Trump and Musk and Vance and where they seem to be going with the judiciary.
It feels for the second presidency, though, that he definitely has more of a groundswell of support and some very powerful people around him. Very interestingly, on Fox News, the interview that aired just before the Super Bowl on Sunday, when he was asked whether J.D. Vance would be his successor for the 2028 Republican nomination, he very quickly said no. He's very good. But and I think, you know, what happens with that? Like, does he sort of then look to the Constitution as to whether a president can be elected for a third term? This all signals a very interesting chapter in American political history of how far a president can now go. And I think the other interesting element of this is what will happen with the economy and whether that is something that could shake things up a little bit. And I'm referring here to the Wall Street Journal reporting that for CEOs and bankers that the Trump euphoria is fading fast, that consumers are losing confidence in the economy, observers are expecting inflation, and business leaders are finding that trying to navigate Trump's on-again, off-again tariffs is taking all their attention. He banked so heavily on being a businessman, on being a non-Washington DC person, coming in that first term and by his own accounts, effectively saving America and the American economy. He's coming with that mandate again. If that starts to weaken, perhaps his support will also start to weaken. And then if that happens, he's obviously, I think in a little bit of trouble. But in the meantime, the trouble is indeed for what you've both identified correctly, I think, as well, what happens now from a separation of powers perspective, from a political power perspective. And not just that, that also extends to foreign policy as well and the support that he has internationally. He hosted the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. They spoke extensively about what will happen in Gaza. And Trump's now suggesting that the US will effectively take over Gaza, that the Palestinian people will be resettled in other countries. He's threatened Egypt and Jordan of withdrawing US aid from those two countries if they don't take the Palestinian people. And that, that Gaza could become a Middle Eastern Riviera. And more worryingly, that by this weekend, if the organization Hamas, which is recognized as a terrorist organization across the world, does not release the Israeli hostages that it took from the 7th of October attacks year before last, that all hell would break loose. Ozan, what's the next chapter for what will play out in the situation in Gaza with these comments by Donald Trump?
I think, as we said last week, it's anybody who knows what's going to happen in Gaza is making foolish claims. So I've never been shy to make foolish claims, but I think it's Trump, and it's the way that he's operating domestically is no different to the way he's operating internationally. He is making these bold threats, and again, he's sending the message, if you're in my way, I will bulldoze through you. We saw with the Mexico and Canada tariffs, they called him on his bluff But as is the case with a lot of diplomacy, nobody loses face. But certainly Trump didn't get a win. He got commitments from Mexico and Canada about things that they had already flagged they were going to do in December, before in anticipation of him taking over. So I don't think that these are shallow threats. I think he's likely to follow through with a lot of these sorts of things. But, you know, in the last 6 to 12 months, all hell has been unleashed on Gaza. I mean, what else can he do, or is he going to do? Of course, the ceasefire can come to a premature end, and that would be a horrible, horrible outcome. But, you know, if his intention is to clear out Gaza and build whatever it is he wants to build, I mean, he views it as a real estate development opportunity. If that's his intention, then I can't think of anything more hellish than that for the almost 2 million Gaza residents who are going to be displaced from their land, and who haven't been already, but will definitely be, and, you know, placed in countries who for the last 50 years have effectively really shied away from accepting them, and who don't want them to live there. They don't want to live there. So at the end of the day, he has the levers, and this is why we're having these conversations. And this is why, you know, for many, many months, many people have been saying that Donald Trump poses a serious threat. It's because he has the levers, he can pull them and get his way. And if he wants to go down that path, then all we're going to see, I would suspect, is further instability in the region, and further, which will at some point equate to further instability domestically for the US. And your points about the economy are very interesting, and I, you know, concur 100%. I think at some point, after his 100 days of 65 press releases a day and all of the news cycles, once that ends, at some point he's going to have to get down to governing. And we've said many times on this podcast that he's not shown himself to be great at governing. He's shown himself to be a very capable communicator, a campaigner, and he certainly didn't demonstrate that he was great at governing in his first term. So to me, that's the real test, because, you know, the price of eggs, the price of petrol, all of these economic pressures, the pressures on the cost of living, these are not going to magically go away. He needs to do something. And I've not seen yet anything that shows that he's taking these issues seriously. He's more concerned about buying Greenland, redeveloping Gaza, all of the things that are irrelevant to the reason for why he was elected. And I think he's going to try and continue this whole flooding the zone strategy beyond his 100 days. But at some point, I suspect politically he's going to be in trouble, because people will be wondering why we're talking about buying Greenland when they're going to continue to pay high prices for everyday products.
Yeah, look, I think the whatever difficulties there are about the ceasefire and potential actions of the IDF that has caused Hamas to say that they're not going to release any more hostages until whatever comes into place, the fact that Trump's able to dictate, or feels able to dictate, to Israel when they should and shouldn't be on a ceasefire, and make threats that he obviously doesn't intend to carry out himself, but intends the Israelis to carry out. And, you know, it's not great from their position either, because the fact of the ceasefire wasn't unattractive to Israel. They, you know, there's only so many targets you can bomb, or so many military actions you can launch. I, you know, without it just sort of, you know, Hamas is still there. Hamas will be galvanized to an extent with support on the ground by Trump's comments about displacing everyone, and they'll be seen as the only organization or entity who can stop that from happening. And at the same time, Trump's making threats on behalf of Israel about what's going to happen if the hostages aren't returned, and what is and goading or pressurizing Israel into removing a ceasefire, for which there'll be limited off ramps again, other than another cycle of negotiations, having got elected, priding himself that he was going to go and stop all these conflicts around the world. He's now goading one of them to start again. It's just so lacking in any sort of diplomacy. It's remarkable. Yes, there are times when you have to use a stick as well as a carrot, politically and diplomatically. But this is just not. This is just opening your mouth and letting words roll out. And occasionally they're in a coherent sentence. And on this occasion, it's about threats of what Israel's going to do if the hostages aren't released with his blessing. It is what it is. I think you know what I mean. But again, it's just an example of how someone without clear thought and thinking through what the next steps are of any action can make things an awful lot worse.
Well, one of the things he has set in his sights is the bribery of foreign officials, but in this context, the lack of enforcing against those who engage in such practices. Ozan, tell us what's happening there.
So, according to media reports, President Trump has effectively issued an executive order that puts a pause on the enforcement of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Now, in the spirit of putting things simply, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act is quite a comprehensive act that enables businesses, or prohibits, let's say, businesses, US businesses, when they're operating overseas, from effectively indulging or being involved in acts such as bribery, things that might be perceived as corruption. It's a very far-reaching act, one that in my professional career, and I'm sure we all have in our professional career, have come across it. And it is there to ensure that US businesses are first and foremost themselves operating and in an environment which is fair, without corruption, but also promoting a business environment that is effectively transparent, accountable, and without corruption. So it's an important act, particularly in many of the countries that I've worked in, and it is a really, really critical act to ensure that that business practices are accountable. So he has asked the Department of Justice to review certain actions that have been taken in the past under this act. He has also asked the Department of Justice to revise some of the guidelines on how to enforce this act. I think it's a little bit early to see or to tell what that actually means. I suspect it's one of those things. In fact, he tried to do this in his first term. It didn't get much traction. I suspect it's one of those things that he's pushed again to the top of the agenda. Like many other things that he's issued executive orders on, I think it will be one of those things that we need to monitor and wait and see how that shapes up, how the review or what type of recommendations the review comes up with to ensure that you know they kind of amend the guidelines. His argument is that the law is a bad one. And it means that many American companies are being disadvantaged by it because it creates a unlevel playing field, I believe is what he's suggesting.
Can't bribe people and others can. That's basically it, right?
I mean, you said it, my friend. You said it. but look, that's all you can take away from it, that I believe that he thinks that laws preventing US companies from bribing officials in Africa, Southern Asia, wherever, are too strict and they're unfair to US companies. He wants to effectively loosen them up. This is what that we're all reading into it. And again, I come back to the politics of this. There will be nothing stopping him from doing it because he has been able to convince, like he has with the trade, this absurd notion of trade surpluses, he has been able to convince the public that America is getting a raw deal and America is getting a disadvantage. The world is against America. So they need to put America first and they need to ensure that they will remove things that are disadvantaging America from prospering. So this is just another one of those things in a long list of items that he has highlighted, which in his mind is disadvantaging American companies. So wait and see. But this is a big problem, I think, in the long term.
So there's one other potential interesting point on this is what might sit under it might not be the we need to make American companies more competitive by enabling them to outbid their competitors on bribery. Because the new guidelines will trigger a pause in existing prosecutions, and therefore those who are subject to prosecution will just have to wait around until and if new guidelines are issued. And there's 31 companies currently being investigated under this. And I'm sure that journalists will be working overtime to try and identify whether any of those companies have any links to the current administration, either through the type likes of Musk or other, you know, prominent Republicans or prominent MAGA enthusiasts. And then it's going to come straight back to Donald Trump that he's looking to manipulate the judicial system for those who are close to him. So there might be something else tumbles out on this, depending on who those companies are and what they've been accused of. Because at the minute, while it's paused, nothing's happening, you can't lose. And I'm sure they'd be happier to have no guidelines replacing those in a very long pause than new guidelines being issued, even if more beneficial to being able to do certain practices, but might actually allow the current investigations to resume.
And one thing also worth just explaining here is, again, to put simply, the US companies are not the only companies in the world that are covered by such laws. In fact, one could argue that the UK Bribery Act is even more strict than the US FCPA. I'll let the lawyers argue that. But at the end of the day, Canada has them, UK, EU, Australia, and many other countries that you would not expect them to have, these sorts of laws have them on the books. So, again, it is great politics. It is great deception to suggest that US companies are unfairly treated and are disadvantaged because they have to follow rules that others don't. It's absolutely false. Other companies from other parts of the world follow even stricter rules. So just wanted to put that simply.
Well, to end the Trump segment on a more lighter note, I guess, one person who used to be from the UK and I guess is kind of not anymore is, of course, Prince Harry, who seems to have survived a potential Trump deportation. Prince Harry, of course, lives in California with his wife, the actress Meghan Markle, who, has been a controversial couple for a very long time. And Trump ruled it out this week, saying that he'll leave him alone because apparently he has enough problems with his wife. So never shy, Mr. Trump, to engage in some celebrity gossip as well. And I think he was very happy that he was cheered on at the Super Bowl while Taylor Swift was booed, of course, after his comments saying that Taylor Swift is terrible once she endorsed Kamala Harris in the US presidential election. Let's move overseas now, and the Philippines is back in action with political campaigning off a fragile and fractured political backdrop. Rodney, take us through what's happening there.
The vice president is subject to impeachment proceedings on allegations of corruption and a conspiracy or a plot to kill the president, has been mooted in the press as part of this as well. So there's clearly a little bit more digging around what exactly has triggered this impeachment. Obviously, the vice president, who's Duterte's daughter, and the president is Marcos's son, So we have these two political dynasties that came together 2 years ago or whatever, to win the election. And now that the potential for a contest against each other to future elections come up, the wheel seems to have come off this unity ticket as it was presented earlier. But the impeachment around corruption is, I mean, nothing new. It feels like corruption in politics in the Philippines is a rite of passage. But I do think it's a potentially a good example of where political dynasties, when they come together to win an election, fall out very quickly afterwards. Obviously, political dynasties are very big in the US, Kennedy, Bush, Clinton, Roosevelt, but also in India, in Pakistan, in Thailand, in Myanmar, in Indonesia, Southeast Asia after the US is probably the greatest home to these multi-generational political families. And what we've got in the Philippines is two who decided to work together in the short term. And it looks like longer term, the relationship's going to be a very sour one, but it's certainly worth watching because there's also a underlying issue about Marcos is leaning towards the US, the vice president leaning towards China a little bit more, and so on. So it does impact on Philippines foreign policy, as well as a political battle within the country. And it's going to obviously harm investment, potentially many other aspects, economic aspects, which come from this type of very public falling out, as we've currently had. Ozan, you like the Philippines politics?
No, it's a very interesting time in Philippines politics, and it's also very interesting that it's two political dynasties, but one has been around for 30, 40 years. Obviously, again, to put things simply, the current president is a part of the Marcos family, who had ruled the Philippines during the 70s and 80s, I believe, if my memory is correct. And then, of course, the vice president is the daughter of the former President Duterte, and who he effectively wasn't from an established dynasty, but he spent two terms as president, was termed out, and he's clearly built up a dynasty, which is now being kind of fronted by his daughter. So that it just goes to show you how these political dynasties are able to amass power. And if you have a look at it, it's a group of allies and family members of the Marcos family who are in the House of Representatives, or their Congress effectively, and the Senate, who are pushing a lot of this impeachment. Again, very close allies and members of the Duterte family who are defending the vice president. So it's going to be interesting and not unusual, I suppose, in that part of the world. I think countries like Indonesia and Malaysia, have had a long line of political families, and it's interesting to see that these things are kind of history is repeating itself.
Well, speaking of political controversies, I guess, and interesting political developments, Romania, the president there has resigned just as an impeachment vote was about to be cast following the cancellation of the country's presidential elections last year. Rodney, you've had your eye on Romania for a while. What's going on there?
Yes, he was going to be impeached as a response to the election being cancelled to be rerun in May of this year, and it was again over foreign interference. It was a ruling by the highest court in Romania, which was clearly honored by the incumbent leadership. But now it looks like Romania is going to have an interim president until then, and the pressure's going to be on, no doubt, on all areas to ensure that that election goes the way of the outlier who won it on the first vote, and so on. So we'll see what happens. But I think losing the president at this stage, who was a figure of continuity and stability and all those other things, while this other electoral problem had to be resolved, brings in a higher degree of chaos and a greater degree of instability. Romania is very much within the sights of Russian influence, as are their friends in Moldova, who were getting a touch from Russia this week because of their use of Romanian, and now is an official language, Russian also being widely spoken. So it's an area where Russia's pretty hot on what's happening. Romania's had a difficulty with the election at the end of last year. The stability point to rerun the election was the sitting president, who's now gone. And you've now got an interim president who isn't as high profile, not as established, and might be less adept at maneuvering around whatever pressures come on in the run-up to the election, as well as overseeing what we all hope will be a free and fair election in Romania, and a proper democratic outcome. There have been street protests and so on whipped up by the right in Romania to put pressure on the president in recent weeks, and then the impeachment process was initiated by right-wing elements again within the legislature. So impeachment seems to be a it's more popular than tariffs as a word, I think, possibly.
Well, I'm taking bets on how long it takes for Elon Musk to come out in support of the candidate that's been the ultra nationalist candidate that's been supported by Russia. So let's see how long it takes before he starts to make some sort of comments, because it's a, from what I understand, it's quite a Trumpy type of character, right up Elon Musk's alley. So yeah, he might have another. Sorry,
Musk will be Trump's Achilles heel, because all this efficiency stuff he's done within business, where you don't have to keep anyone on board, and he's doing it in government, and he's punishing voters potentially. And he's never had to win over support from a worker base with any of these actions before. He will be Trump's Achilles heel over the next few months. Watch Musk's approval rating drop.
Well, it will be interesting to see what role he plays in various other elections, because it's probably a topic for another podcast. But it's certainly he's got his fingers in a lot of pies. But I agree with you. I think Musk is at some point there's going to be a bit of tension between Musk and the vice president and the president. Anyway, that was my lame attempt at a joke.
You saw the Time magazine piece that had Musk on sitting at Trump's desk, and Trump was asked to comment on it, and he said, "What are they still publishing, Time magazine? I didn't know they were still in existence." This is the same Time magazine who he praised in December when they gave him Man of the Year. So it's not often that Trump goes a day without getting prickly over something that a real politician wouldn't cast a second thought about.
Honestly, I've said it before, I'll say it again, you could not make this stuff up if you tried. I really think this will be the theme of this podcast throughout the year. And no one better to be having on the podcast to be discussing these things. Rodney McCune and Ozan Ibrahim, thank you so much, gents, for your time this week. See you next.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
And that's been this week's episode of Put Simply. Be sure to follow us on LinkedIn at Oroka Group to stay up to date with all the latest episodes and news. Feel free to leave a comment and suggestions on what you'd like to see featured on the podcast as well. Until next time, I'm Erdem Koch.
And I'm Ozan Ibrahim.
Thanks for listening.